Greetings, dear listeners, and welcome to Negotiating Ideas, a podcast about political thought on democracy, pluralism, and peace. This is Omar Sadeh. As I told you in the previous episode, I'm going to dedicate a series of episodes to academic freedom from the perspective of exiled Afghanistan social scientists. In the previous episode, I had the privilege to speak with two political scientists based in the US. In this episode, I am honored to have Dr. Arun Motasim from Humboldt University, Germany, and Dr. Qasim Wafaizadeh from Kanazawa University, Japan. Arun was assistant professor of law at Kabul University since 2005, with 8 years of background as the vice dean of law faculty. Meanwhile, he has been an assistant professor of law at American University of Afghanistan since 2008, and the founder of legal studies program with the support of the Law School of Stanford University in the US. Currently, Arun is Philip Schwartz Initiative Fellow at the Law School of Humboldt University, Berlin, with a focus on his research on the theory and practice of dealing with war crimes in Afghanistan. Dr. Qasim Wafaizadeh is a specially appointed professor of peace and conflict studies at Kanazawa University, Japan. He has taught at various universities in Afghanistan and has a rich and diverse background as practitioner and scholar. He obtained his doctorate in international relations in 2013 from Kanazawa University. In this wide-ranging conversation, we delve into the profound challenges they have faced as an exiled scholar navigating new academic environments, balancing scholarly neutrality in the face of totalitarian regime like the Taliban. We explored the meaning of a scholar in exile and the responsibility of academics in resisting the oppression. Moreover, they examined the broader implication of Taliban's rule for their respective disciplines. Their insights shed light on the immense cost of totalitarian rule for Afghanistan's academics and how the war has shaped the study of Afghanistan itself. On to the podcast. Welcome both. Well, so let me ask the first question to both of you. How did the collapse of Republic impacted your academic career? So as your bio said, you were both academics in Afghanistan, and you were forced to leave the country. And currently you are residing in two different continents, in two different countries. How this transition shaped and impacted your career? So let me start with Dr. Arun.
Thank you, Dr. Sadeh. First, let me thank you for inviting me in this podcast. And also, I extend my greetings to the ones who are listening to this podcast. I think the answer to this question is very simple. It had really a tremendous impact on our academic career. In fact, although I wasn't actually purely working in the academic institution, because parallel to working as a university instructor, I was working or professor, I was working with the governmental institutions and non-governmental institutions simultaneously. But the main job and the main career of mine was academic, because I have always been proud of that, and that has been the main. The other things have always been engine, or maybe something in the margins of my career, particularly when it comes to academic and non-academic areas. But overall, in fact, the impact of it is not only that we have lost connection with our academic institution, but it's actually losing all those academic values on the ground that we had. It's not only related to ourselves, it's actually to the institutions. Because in some jurisdictions, in some countries, people lose their connection with their institutions, and they cannot actually be anymore dealing with their institution and will not be able to teach or research in that institution. But for us, that's not the case. Ours is so severe that those institutions even have lost their status as academic institutions. So that's more devastating rather than actually connecting it to our own stories. But overall, I could actually briefly mention that the impact of whatever happened by the fall of the country to hands of the Taliban and academic environment of Afghanistan has been so devastating that we need another generation or at least two decades to just get back to the point, from the point of view of losing the cadre, losing the momentum that was actually created in terms of following the pace of academic developments in the world, because in 2001, particularly when I'm talking about the time that the Taliban first was actually collapsed and then the Republic came into power. Since that, academic institutions could survive. And then to come to a stage to claim that they are academic institutions, to turn back the research aspect of academic life rather than being a teaching institution. But then after that, in the last 5 years, we were just trying to struggle as academic institutions, or I'm talking about institutions, because they were slowly, but taking actually responsibilities as academic institutions. But what happened now, this is completely in the other direction, in the opposite direction, because we are just turning academic institutions to sort of dictated madrasa type of institutions that people should actually learn whatever they are told. You do not have any ability or opportunity to just challenge things. So I didn't want to just mention it in regard to myself and solely focusing that on myself, but definitely if we talk about the institutions and the impact of the collapse on all the academic institutions and existing structure, then definitely we can understand that that has been in fact impactful on us as well. But I will just come to the other questions probably in the course of your other questions, but just I wanted to be brief to this extent. Thank you.
Of course, of course. How was your experience, Dr. Wafaizadeh, on the same question and the transition that you faced with respect to the change of regime in Afghanistan, how the Republic and the collapse of Republic impacted your career?
Thank you, Dr. Sadr. Thank you for having me on this series of podcasts. As Dr. Mutasim, explained, the collapse of the government back in 2021, it was catastrophic for all Afghans. So the impact was very vast and deep on all segments of the society, and especially on, academic society in Afghanistan. So, including us. However, I was also, oscillating between being a practitioner and a scholar, while I was back in the country. But this has been also my main, focus, doing research and, teaching in different universities. So it has been, difficult for all of us. Today, before, defining myself as a scholar in exile, I would, define myself as, a citizen, an Afghan citizen in exile. Because, when you're exiled, when you're immigrate, when you flee your country, so it means that you are separated, you're cut off from the very environment that you've used to, that you've been born and raised, and you had your social connections, your friends, the familiar, faces around you, the familiar, social culture and social and cultural institutions, academic institutions, and collective objective of academic society of Afghanistan to contribute to the development, political, social, and economic development of this of the country, of Afghan society. So those all those dreams has been shattered. And more than thinking of myself sometime, when I'm looking to the process of, the process that, Afghan academic institutions are going through, which I call it, madrasification of academic institution in Afghanistan, that they are downgraded and degraded into, local madrasas. So they are trying to make them devoid of academic capacity. So, of course, one side of, the story is the, capital flight, because of the violent situation, because of these because of the official policy of cracking down on freedom of expression. You know, you cannot teach what you want. So you just need to teach what they want. You need to frame your thoughts. And that's not the way that knowledge and science, you know, could flourish. So that has caused, you know, capital flight. That's one side of the story. On the other side, so there is an intentional, you know, projection of this matrixification process on academic institutions that will have deep impact, you know, on the future generations of Afghanistan and the existing capacity of academic institutions inside the country. Sometimes when I'm in, you know, talking with students, friends back in the country, you know, sometimes they would say that, you know, simply that we would like you guys to be here and would like to learn from you. And some of them would, you know, take more critical tone that, you know, so if you're teaching in different, you know, countries around the world, that, you know, doesn't make sense, you know, that doesn't have to do anything with us because your primary liability and responsibility lies to your country. But of course, we all know that the situation back in the country does not allow us to work and teach as a scientist, a political scientist. So we cannot frame our thought. So this is the first, you know, aspect that we are citizens, you know, in exile. And of course, connecting when you're cut off from that root, from that environment. So to, you know, adopt to the new, a new situation and come over to all those, you know, destabilizing situation that you're facing, you know, facing as an exile. Exiled academic, that is, you know, a very difficult process that you need to go through, adjust yourself to a new academic or new social and cultural environment above all, because not you're not going to an island, an academic island, you are going to a different cultural context, social context, so you need to adjust yourself to that environment. And it's not a really easy transition. Of course, you know, we cannot say that, you know, science is divided in different frontiers, you know, the same as, you know, nation states. So science and, you know, knowledge is universal. You cannot just label it as Afghan science or, for example, foreign science. But of course, we as persons, need to adjust ourselves, go through a transitional, you know, transition process. Some might even face a, you know, cultural shock for some even, you know. And that's one part, that's the other part of story. But in addition, most of Afghan scholars have not been able to find, you know, a job in the academic, you know, institutions outside the country. So they are working, some of them that I know are working as simple labor forces. So that's a very sad story with, you know, a number of books that they have written and published with, you know, years of experience. Some might, you know, have the problem with language, but even with sufficient knowledge of the local language, you know, they have not been able to find a job. So it means that they need to adjust and they need to find the techniques, you know, the ways, the mechanisms for, you know, securing a job, you know, in the new environment. So these are all some things that I've experienced and most of the Afghan scholars in exile have experienced.
Great. So let me come to the same point that you use about the transition and the academics phase while leaving their country behind and joining the Western institutions or whatever else across the world. Coming to Dr. Harun Mohtasem, how was this transition? How has been this transition for you from Kabul to Germany? So you had your PhD going on. probably that was an easy step for you to reconnect with those institutions, with the faculty. But beyond that, how do you find this transition to an academic job market in Germany really challenging for yourself?
Thank you, Dr. Sader. Yeah, I think let me just clarify one thing, that at the time that the collapse took place, I already was done with my PhD, because I defended my PhD in February 2021, and then the collapse took place in August 2021. But still, I was actually on a type of visa, because whenever you just finish a degree in Germany, you can have 1.5 years of sort of a type of visa that's called job search visa, that you could just look for a job or something like that. So they gave you that visa. I was on that type of visa when I returned back to Germany. But the complication, in fact, maybe it seems very easy if you have studied in that country and you could go back and then you could start your career there in the academic institution. But that's not that simple, particularly with my background, which is in the field of law, because we all understand that laws are very local. And unlike political science and international relations that you two are actually sort of experts of, for us, when it comes to law, then definitely you, if you are actually particularly trained in the local or national laws or domestic laws, the chances of, in fact, finding an opportunity outside or abroad is very difficult. In any jurisdiction, it's difficult, but it actually turns to be more difficult in European context, particularly in the German context, because in Germany, the rules and the laws are set in a way, or the policies are set in a way, that you either have studied German, or else the chances of finding an opportunity in the legal field, particularly in the academic legal field, is so limited. For that reason, even sometimes I'm told by some colleagues that if you're intending to just find a job, sort of an academic job in a university, that would be 2%, and 98% the chances are not there. So if we take that into consideration, that's not an easy job. But since after the collapse, there were opportunities for scholars, at least I call that temporary opportunities, because from an academic point of view, 2 years, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years of opportunity for an academic person to find himself or herself in another country, in another jurisdiction, is very difficult, particularly in the field of law, while it requires that at least you have to have 5 years of German law background and have a law degree in Germany to be able to just be part of an institution. And also on the top of that, we all are cognizant of this reality that in Germany, faculty positions, or that they call it chairs, are very limited. Even there are hundreds, and I could say thousands, of German citizens who are qualified and young Germans that they are eligible for becoming professors, but due to lack of existence of those positions or those chair positions, they cannot actually secure those positions for themselves. So they go from one institution to another. Then it's not a challenge for us, but the challenge actually is changing layer by layer. When it comes to Germans, then they have the challenge to find a permanent job in a university. But when it comes to us, particularly that we are not trained in this jurisdiction, and then second, we are not speaking the language, because although in academic institutions you could go and speak English with the professors and people, but when it comes to being holder of a career or a job in an institution, that turns to a different situation, because you have to speak the language. And speaking the language, not to in that level that you could actually solve the problems, but we all understand that legal language is not actually that simple language. If you are able in all areas of social science, but when it comes to law, it has its own complications. So it was so challenging for me, but luckily, personal connections here provided me the opportunity to just secure this Philip Schwarz Initiative fellowship, which I took that for 2 years at Humboldt University, and the 2 years are actually finishing in some days, and the extension I got for another year. But again, I say that even 3 years will not be sufficient enough, because they say that in 3 years you have to find your way. But What's our definition from finding your way? Why you do not have the basics of the language? You do not have any degree in law in that country. Someone may say that, okay, what about actually finding an opportunity to be licensed as a bar member or actually someone like that to practice law? That's also not possible in Germany because here you only would be licensed if you are actually trained in German law. But the only opportunity for a foreign lawyer who could practice or at least be recognized as a lawyer would be that they would recognize as an expert of foreign laws, which in practice, if you go to that, at the end of the day, I ask that what would be the benefit of that? They said nothing, but just you will be recognized. So just the recognition is not something that would heal the wounds of us losing everything back in the country and then... And on the top of that, losing hope, because before I, in the first question, I didn't touch upon that issue. In fact, it's not only institutions that we have lost, the career that we lost, we have lost hope. Honestly, for almost 2 years from the time that the collapse took place, I wasn't able to just write a sentence. Can you believe that? Because it wasn't actually that I lost everything because of that, but because I was looking at myself that I can do nothing. When you see your ability to have an impact or to at least be able to do something in reducing the harm that's happening in your country and in your institution and into your people, then in that case, that's the most devastating situation, particularly when I was talking to students, particularly female students from law school at Kabul University, from law school, from the American University, although they had the opportunity, but still from mostly from Kabul University and other universities that I had connection with. Definitely, it was really, really, really harmful to us that wasn't actually allowing us to write the sentence. So for that reason, then to summarize what I said, in fact, it wasn't easy from the beginning to start, but it's not easy in the middle now that I am in. And I don't see a very bright future in the future as well, because if I summarize it into 3 stages. But still, I'm hopeful that probably there might be opportunities, even if it's not actually purely in the academic institutions, but other institutions, semi-academic institutions that they deal with research, like institutions that they deal with the areas that are actually close to our areas, like transparency, accountability, which are the areas that I'm trained in criminal law mostly, and also the issues related to international and transnational criminal laws. So those are the areas that I'm now focusing on to just find my way in this society, in this community. But that doesn't, in any means, it doesn't mean that there is no support. There is support, but the laws have actually tied the hands of people who are trying to support you in the academic institutions, because
I will come to that support and how you navigated and how you found several alternative paths towards continuing your academic career. But it's really painful. You, Dr. Wafaizadeh, spoke about the cultural shock. You spoke about how mentally it drains you. And it's really painful for an academic whose job is to write and think and reflect and always be in dialogue and conversation to come to a stage where these things become impossible. So Germany is, of course, quite a difficult place to navigate for a scholar of law. And I suppose Japan is also not much different, given the cultural particularity and homogeneity of Japan. Tell us about job market of political science in Japan. How is that? How did you navigate it in the last 2 years that you have been there?
For me as well, it was easier because I was an alumni. I graduated from Kanazawa University back in 2013. So when I left the country and they learned about that, so I was, invited. They were so quick to extend an invitation for me, to join Kanazawa University as a specially appointed professor. So, I took that offer and I went to the institution, which was, totally, familiar to me. So it was not a really difficult transition. Of course, the Japanese language is an issue, and that's a barrier, because I only, I'm able to speak Japanese for, non-academic you know, things, but not for academic purpose. So that requires a high, you know, proficiency, level of proficiency, language proficiency. So I'm teaching, for example, my classes all, you know, I do conduct my research all in English language. So in a Japanese academic, you know, institution. So that is like to, you know, teach in English in any in a country that English is not a spoken, you know, widely spoken language. But that is of course, you know, one challenge. But you know, and Dr. Seb Motasem, you know, explained rightfully. That's one of the things is that you go through this transition period in every institution. As far as I know, you know, universities has provided some sort of protection or support to their graduates or alumni, you know. But you know that you can call that as a, you know, grace period. So that protection is you know, temporary. So that's immediate. It provides you the immediate support that you need. But of course, in order to integrate, you know, into the market, you know, the job market of the country that you have moved to, so you need to adjust yourself, you know, to the situation there, which is highly competitive. And for someone psychologically impacted by the devastating situation back in your country, even if you have moved out, you know, your relatives are there. And, you know, on the daily basis, you might be hearing, you know, intimidation and sad stories, you know, from the country, from inside the country. So I can understand, I can understand. We've been all through that situation, you know, that what Dr. Seb Motasem said, that, you know, that we've not been able to write a single sentence for a long, you know, period of time. Because to do, you know, academic work requires, you know, concentration, focus, you know, peace of mind. You know, there is a story. We had a story that in times of Harun al-Rashid, he had a very, you know, skilled, you can call it, you know, it's a khatib or some writer and historiographer, yeah, in his court. So one day he was reading a letter which was written to the, you know, Roman Empire. He found that an irrelevant, you know, phrase was included, that bread is over. And then it continued, you know. So then he summoned him and asked why, you know, this irrelevant, you know, phrases in this letter, which is addressed to the Roman Empire. Mm-hmm. And he said, oh, well, pardon me, you know, while I was writing and I was totally focused on writing this letter, my wife came in, you know, and just, you know, told me that the bread is over. Yeah. So this is the situation with all African scholars, that they are, you know, most of them might not have been in a fortunate, like us, to have previous connections, you know, with, you know, academic institutions. So, and I can imagine that they've been, you know, they should have been, you know, through a more, much more difficult, you know, transitional process. And right. They should have been struggling, right. You know, how to secure a job. And that's the case for others as well. So this great period, you know, grace period ends. And then you need to find a permanent job. As far as I know, all Afghan scholars right. has been, you know, have been offered, you know, fellowships or, you know, sort of jobs which are not, you know, to say a career position. So that's just for a very, you know, short period of time. So it means that they will provide you a window, a time window to, you know, adjust yourself, complete the transition process, learn update yourself and learn about, you know, the new environment and the more, you know, than the job market, and enable yourself to compete in that highly competitive, you know, market.
Earlier you mentioned about being in exile as a citizen, but also most of us are also considered, quote unquote, as a scholar in exile, or threatened a scholar. So now I would like to get both of your opinions about what does exile mean for academics. You referred, of course, to those mental challenges, to those academic challenges and institutionally, and intellectual challenges. But here, do you think that the titles such as threatened scholars or scholars in exile are exotic labels that you do not want to associate or label yourself with it? Or maybe it is sometimes at this stage of your career, it's okay to carry this and the notion of scholars in exile. So what's your take on it, Dr. Motassem?
Let's be honest that regardless of accepting or not accepting these labels, or considering ourselves as a scholars in exile or not, or agreeing with these terms or not, but when it comes to reality, we all are actually in that situation. We are in exile, and we have a background in academic institutions, and that definitely puts us in that situation of being an academic in exile, particularly for the ones who are in fact in different academic institutions now as fellows, as or one way or the other, we affiliated to those institutions. So to me, regardless of the type of terminology that we use, for instance, some people say that we are scholars at risk. Some people say that we are scholars in exile. Some people say that we are scholars. Some people say that we are exiled, as Dr. Saeb Wafai mentioned, citizens in exile. But overall, all those terms could be true for all of us, depending on the situation and circumstances that we are at. For instance, if we are considering ourselves as a citizen of a country that's actually collapsed and we are not allowed to go back there, then we are an exiled citizen. And when it comes to our academic background, then definitely when we attach that, we are academics in exile because we are not allowed to go back. Regardless what the reason is, for us at the current time, there is no war going on, but still there is the fear of persecution for a majority of the scholars who are here, particularly the ones who are active. I often say that, in fact, when I see the other scholars in mostly in gatherings of academics or scholars at risk, I see them that they often go back and forth to their countries, but their concern is that they will not be allowed to just have opinions or ideas that are not, in fact, well received by the government or by the institutions in that government. But when it comes to us, I often explain it that for us, it's completely different because in our country back under the control of the Taliban, activism in general is forbidden. Unless it's for promotion of Talibanism, terrorism, radicalism, or fundamentalism. Other than that, everything is banned. I often say that for us, for instance, for many people, for lawyers or for academics in the field of law, they are not facing those challenges and those problems like political science scholars or people that they write about politics and stuff like that. But when it comes to legal area, then they are not mostly in danger. Maybe sometimes their ideas will not be well received and they will be, in fact, in trouble temporarily. But when it comes to us, particularly the regime that's totally against laws and regulations and rules, or completely against rule of law in a society and just by relying on Islamic Sharia, while they themselves may not believe in those values, they just try to create an opportunity for themselves. But whenever somebody talks about those values and challenges them, then they definitely disagree with that person. So for them, it's very simple to eradicate you whenever you express an idea which is opposite of them. So when I come to these gatherings or to these institutions, I often say that we are facing or experiencing a very different situation. And I personally, I believe that Sometimes it has negative consequences. We have to be cognizant of this reality that when we say we are scholars in exile or we are academics at risk or whatsoever, then definitely that would be a drawback in terms of finding an opportunity in an open competition, particularly you're considered to be not part of the system that's existing in that community or society. But we have to be also cognizant of one reality that sometimes that might be an opportunity for you as well, depending on what situation or what circumstances are you at and to whom are you talking or to what institution are you actually discussing when or with what institution are you discussing about those issues. Maybe that would be a plus point for you. But in fact, personal opportunities definitely does not actually change the status of those terms being defined one way or the other way, and the status of has falling under any of those definitions that are existing there. To me, I would consider myself as an exiled citizen when it comes to being a citizen of Afghanistan, because I'm not allowed as a citizen of that country to go back, because I freely express my views. I'm a believer in Islam. I'm actually a student of Islamic law and Sharia law. I know those values. But the problem is that when I say that the things that God and the Prophet have said, you're not following that, then definitely you're the enemy of them, because they don't want to hear the reality, because they just use that as an opportunity for themselves to rule and to continue and to perpetuate their ruling in the society. So for us, it's always a challenge and difficulty from the angle of being a citizen of that country, not being allowed to go, then we are a citizen in exile. From the point of view of being an academic, while we are not allowed to go back, because right away after we got out of the country, then we are removed from our positions and the new people were hired, in fact, in those positions, which means that we don't have any place in our institution back because we might be labeled as those people. And particularly, I also had the other hat of being an activist on the anti-corruption, transparency and accountability in Afghanistan, particularly in the last 4 years, which I was dealing with those issues, particularly the high-ranking officials of the government in Afghanistan, their corruption cases. And those issues certainly would not actually allow me to be someone tolerated by any groups that they are against accountability, against transparency. And the Taliban will be on the top of those people that they are actually afraid of accountability and responsibility, not only in the field of criminal issues only, but in any field, in any area, starting from economic issues like the issue of mines, the issue of natural resources of Afghanistan, that how they are being actually abused currently from the angle of, for instance, laws, that there is no transparency and accountability, that what's the applicable law? Because in the absence of applicable law, it's very simple for the rulers to suppress people while your acts are not defined at what's allowed and what's not allowed. So easily they can label you that it's against Sharia. I tell you a very specific example about it, that in fact, in the courts, I am in touch with the lawyers back in Afghanistan, and they say that sometimes when you say something that the judge, who is a Talib, doesn't like it, they say that you're just talking about non-Islamic issues. While you say that, what I was talking, they say that you're referring to some of the laws that were actually enacted during the Republic. But you don't understand that. What connection with this and with what is being actually said and what you say is there that you consider me as someone saying something against Islam? But it's very simple to label you. Mm-hmm. So for that reason, then, to summarize, in fact, all those labels could actually be true depending on wherever you are and in what situation you are.
That's right. So it's a conscious status that you are there, and you know that these certain form of threat is not only targeting your life, but also your freedom of consciousness and thinking and freedom of expression. And of course, finally, your career. Is it the same for you, Dr. Wafaizadeh, being a scholar in exile? Do you consider it as exotic, that one should not use it so much and in a state emphasize on it has his or her intellectual capacity, or do you think that these titles, scholar in exile, has certain value?
Well, certainly it's applicable. It has value to use. We may use both. I use self-exiled scholars and scholars at risk. Both of them, we might, you know, categorize or use interchangeably, you know, both terms to define, you know, the situation of African scholars, or to put myself into, you know, position myself into one of these categories. But generally, you know, the issue is that when knowledge, rationality, and reason is threatened, so of course all those scientists, the scholars who adhere by those, you know, very you know, foundational principles, of course, you know, they are at risk. Automatically they can be defined at risk. You can, of course, you know, you can go back, you can, you know, twist your thoughts, turning yourself into, you know, or you know, you can integrate, try to integrate yourself into the propagation machinery of the regime. Just give up, you know, whatever, you know, you believe. So does those, you know, scientific, you know, ethics. If you give up all of them, of course, you may survive somewhere, but that's all what has made us. You know, Rumi, you know, says that, you know, what has made you is your thoughts. The rest is bone and flesh, you know. So for a scholar, what defines him as a scholar is his knowledge, and that's not sufficient.
That's right.
But adhering to those, you know, principles to live a life of reason, a life of rationality, and to adhere to the ethical principles of science and knowledge. If he is adhering that, given the current circumstances and situation in Afghanistan, that puts him at risk. He can lose, you know, his head anytime. If he don't, then he, I cannot define him as a scholar. So it means automatically, you know, you are, you know, a scholar at risk. So what they do is to, you know, opt the, you know, living in exile, to just, you know, maintain their academic integrity. And that is, you know, something that has forced them, even if there is, you know, nothing else to force them, at least that is the force that, you know, made them the scholars, you know, in exile. I heard, you know, a story that once one of the Afghan scholars that I know him, and I don't want to just mention his name, you know, so he told me that once he was trying to reason with, you know, these a member, an official of this de facto authority, the, you know, the that official just, you know, he was short of, you know, reasons and justifications for the subject that they were discussing, and with the knowledge he had, you know, so he was able to persuade everybody else there and to provide the evidence, and as well as to quote from the, you know, religious scriptures, so whatever, you know, was needed for persuasion there. And at the end, what, you know, the official told him, that even though you're quoting, you know, those, you know, hadiths, or, you know, things from these, you know, religious scriptures, we cannot accept it from you. Even if that hadith is true and we should, you know, abide by that, we cannot accept it from you. We cannot hear it from you. Why? Because your outfit is not Islamic enough, based on our definition. So when it means that there is, you know, as Dr. Sermot Asim said, when there is no institutional support, when there is no constitutional order, there is nothing to protect you from this, you know, this anarchic situation that everyone with a gun, you know, thinks of himself as being authorized to act as he will, or based on the interpretation that, yeah, he has actually from religion or the situation. So that creates, you know, an uncertain situation for Afghan scholars and put them at risk. Especially, I want to make, you know, I want to highlight the political or social side, you know, scholars in Afghanistan, because political science and social science, you know, law, legal studies, so all of these, you know, the areas, in essence, they are in conflict with ideological dogma. They challenge, they criticize that. They cannot live, you know, abide by those ideological dogma, which is now, you know, has overwhelmed academic institutions, you know, inside Afghanistan. So they have to, speak their mind. The principles that we've learned, you know, in political science and social science and legal studies, economic studies. So you need to teach about various, theories, which are standing in sharp contradiction with the dominating ideology there. Of course, they are more than anybody, you know, at risk. They cannot teach, they cannot survive the situation, so they have to leave. That's why, you know, definitely, you know, can use these terms, you know, both of these terms, scholars at risk or scholars in exile, for Afghan scholars.
Great. And the last, probably the last section, I would also love to hear from both of you, to what extent and the nature of your discipline, whether it's legal studies, law or Sharia or political science, has been transformed under the Taliban regime. So episodically, you referred to this issue also in your previous remarks. Dr. Mutasim, you say that you are an expert of Sharia law. But the Taliban regime has its own very strict conservative interpretation of it, wherein every single member of the regime probably will consider himself authorized to have that monopoly and interpret and apply whatever he wants, but also considers the previous government's laws and legal bodies as an un-Islamic. To what extent they have transformed faculty of law and political science at Kabul University, where you have been studying there?
Thank you, Dr. Sadr. I think the most important thing is that whenever it comes to the applicable law in the country or in the society, then definitely whatever is applicable in the society or community, that definitely is being taught in the academic institutions, because they have to train and prepare students to that. But the problem currently is that all the laws, including the constitution, I need to use the term suspended, because the term abolishment is very different, and that has the different consequences when you use that. But they are at least suspended. Ironically, the 2004 constitution is still as the enforced constitution on the website of the Ministry of Justice of the Taliban, which is ironic, because it's still there. And I often see that and think about it, that how could that be still there as the law, as the enforced law?
How do you differentiate between suspension and the other term that you used, abolished?
So
legally, there's a
Certainly, because when we talk about abolishment, there should be, in fact, a very specific order or a very specific decision from an authority coming and saying that this is not from an authority that has constitutionally or based on a framework, legal framework, saying that this law, which was actually enforced, is not anymore in force, which that institution should have authority. But seeing that, someone may say that the Taliban, the leadership of the Taliban, does have that authority. But even from that authority, we do not have anything explicit saying that these laws are abolished. They only say that, oftentimes they say that we are applying Sharia, and we don't actually apply the current laws, which is actually implying the suspension of the laws rather than actually abolishing them, because they still are on the website of Ministry of Justice as the enforced laws. So if they are abolished, then they should not exist there. But at least the tendency of the Ministry of Justice has been that if there is a law that's abolished, they definitely write in front of that in parentheses that this law is abolished. But for those existing laws, they are not. But they have only suspended because they say that they are applying Sharia, but they haven't in fact abolished any of those laws. So saying that, in fact, when we come to that angle, then definitely we see the impact of it that, okay, so if Sharia as the dominant legal system of the country is there, what's your definition of Sharia? Particularly because we have had these discussions with many people in different gatherings and different conferences. When we talk about these issues, we say that, okay, people of Afghanistan have been Muslim and they will be Muslim, and definitely the presence and non-presence of the Taliban in power will never have an impact on that. And that has been proven. And then the tendency of dealing with Sharia in different Islamic countries, in almost all the Islamic countries, is that they have a constitution, but they have a Sharia guaranteeing clause, which the 2004 constitution of Afghanistan also had that, which means that Article 3 of our constitution in 2004 was stipulating that no law shall be in contradiction with principles of Islam. Because other than that, it's impossible, because Sharia is so broad. Nobody in no country, in fact, is able currently to say that we are applying Sharia while they do not have a unified codification system in which they say, even if they have Sharia directly applied in their legal system, still they have confined that into codes and laws, like Iran has done that, Saudi Arabia has done that, even if they have Sharia, but still they have codified that, because you have to know the boundaries of that. I tell you an example. For instance, within the Hanafi jurisprudence, we have tens of scholars that they have expressed different views about it. So now when we come to a court and a judge decides about it, if he is relying on the views of Saraghsi as a Hanafi scholar, and the other one in another court, for instance, relying on Abi Bakr Razi views, who is also a Hanafi scholar, then at the end of the day, it's not a unified legal system in the country, because the views are so different that they will not actually be, in fact, securing or safeguarding the principle of equality before the laws or equal application of the laws. So for that reason, that's the problem. People of Afghanistan have never said that we are standing against Sharia, against Islam. But what's your definition from Sharia? You see, they say that they are applying Hanafi jurisprudence in Afghanistan because we have majority of people in this country as Hanafi followers. But then at the end of the day, if you go to the book of Haqqani, the chief justice of the Taliban, who has written that, in majority of the points, since they do not find any rigidity in the Hanafi jurisprudence, they resort to Salafi scholars, and they actually narrate or talk about the narrations that they have from them, which in reality, they are opposing them, and even they are killing the scholars of Salafi. But then at the end of the day, in the book, you see many references to those books and to those things. So at the end of the day, it's not application of Sharia, and it's not, in fact, confinement within the Sharia, but rather it's, in fact, enforcing a mechanism through which they could suppress people. Because I'll tell you another example, because I was working on, this is a very interesting example, because I was reviewing the law, which is the only law, I could call it, the law that's actually changed or enacted during the regime of the Taliban, the law on organizational structure of the office that's dealing with or following up the edicts or decrees of the Amir of the Taliban. And that's the institution that used to be called Attorney General's Office, because that institution has changed. The mandate of that and the responsibilities and authorities of that has changed to an institution following the decrees of Amir of the Taliban. And interestingly, there is a definition from corruption that whatever that's against the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan is considered corruption, or any action or movement that's for defaming the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan is in fact corruption. Then the reference to that is a definition of corruption, which says that abusing the public funds for your personal interest, which is a definition from an Arab scholar. And the text of the article and the footnote, both of them are on the same page. But if you see that the article says one thing and refers to the definition, that the definition is completely a different thing. So this is legislation. Mm-hmm. I can say that it's in fact lawmaking, or in fact maybe writing codes, but not codification, because codification has its own rules and regulations. So these are very simple examples of actually dealing with those things and with application of Sharia. But when it comes to the academic institution, legal educational institutions, then the problem and the difficulty is that you're sure that what you're talking about is not enforced in the society and community now. And then as an instructor, as a teacher, as a professor, while you have already censored yourself because you don't want to say something which may create a problem for you, because you have to follow the edicts and the rules that are coming to you, although nobody would directly come and tell you that do this or do that. But the way that they suppress people, definitely you will not have the courage to just go and follow things in a way that will not be in securing the interest of the rulers. But overall, the change in the curriculum, although we don't see that drastic, that they say that all these courses, all these subjects that were related to, for instance, constitutional law, criminal law, they all still exist there. But the order is that you have to sort of deal with the issue or with the course from an Islamic point of view. So definitely, the message is very clear that try to just devalue those things that you're teaching a theoretical basis, whether it's criminal law, constitutional law, whatever. But I need to say that the basis of civil law in Afghanistan is definitely Islamic Sharia, and it's taken from fiqh mostly, not only from Hanafi jurisprudence, but Maliki, Shafi'i, and Hanbali in different occasions. But overall, this is the situation of legal education. And although I often say that I'm not drawing a very rosy picture of the Republic, because we still had with the dual legal education system, a unified court system, we still had problems and challenges and difficulties. But we are just following a direction or a path that was reaching to gradual reform and gradual development in terms of maybe fortifying or supporting the institutions and enabling them to turn to really good institutions or to justice delivery in institutions that people of Afghanistan are seeking. But still, we were in a level that we were going towards the reform, but suddenly something happens that reform was completely gone, but we are just going backwards in terms of legal education and rule of law in the community and society.
Sure. Yeah, of course, I totally echo your point about the nature of Sharia and how diverse, heterogeneous Sharia is. At least two of the scholars that I have read, Walaa al-Haq and one other, Brandon Kendhammer, they argue how the Islamist movement, similar to the Taliban, replicate a colonial construction of Islam, which when colonialism came in 18th and 19th century to most of the Middle East and subcontinent, they realized that Muslim judges are applying different rules to different cases, and they found it chaotic. And that's why colonialism tried to codify what Sharia is. And currently, the Taliban does the same thing. Sharia is quite heterogeneous. You cannot codify it. And codification will create a very homogeneous, restrict, selective cherry-picking. You have to select one scholar's opinion and neglect 1,000 others. And that's not the nature of Sharia. Sharia is, that's why, incompatible with the nature of modern state, as Halaq argues it. Anyway, so let's move on to the to Dr. Wafaizadeh. And you mentioned, Wafaizadeh Sahib, that you consider the current status of academia as madrasaization. So madrasa, for those listeners who do not understand, as the informal legalistic schooling in Islamic law, which currently in most of the Muslim lands, they exclusively teach certain knowledges which are related to religion. So that's sacred knowledge is there, but secular knowledge is neglected. In terms of your discipline, political science or international relations or peace studies, how do you see the transformation? Of course, and then you mentioned about brain drain and how intellectuals and academics left the country. And that, of course, impacts the quality of higher education. But in terms of content, to what extent authoritarian and nature of the Taliban and also their orientation towards religion and Sharia has also impacted these secular, let's say, secular disciplines?
Well, thank you, Dr. Sadr. Just to put it in brief, you know, as a political scientist, so we are dealing, you know, with socio-political, cultural, you know, and economic drivers and dynamics of social, you know, socio-political change, about power politics. You're talking about different ideologies, theories, you know, you cover the whole range of, you know, theories and perspectives in political science, you know, that shapes this, you know, field of, you know, inquiry. So that's, you know, very, you know, vibrant and dynamic field of study. But under the current, you know, situation, so while the Taliban, they cannot, you know, they are dealing, you know, they cannot overcome the predicament, the very predicament that they are now, you know, that have started to feel, you know, because first, as Dr. Tassem mentioned, for example, that the book written by Haqqani, so they, you know, explicitly, that's important. Why? Because, you know, it is forwarded by the leader of the Taliban. So it means that is somehow, you know, certified by him as the official, you know, perspective of the Taliban and their outlook, you know, that they reject any man-made law or civil law. And they say that, you know, the Sharia law suffices. But of course, you know, I remember that, you know, someone asked that how you will regulate, you know, road traffic and, you know, the traffic issues by Sharia. So of course you need some codification, you know, you need codification. So not to mention those, you know, complex, you know, issues that Dr. Sebmatasev mentioned and brought, you know, up, that how you can overcome that. So of course this creates a very, you know, uncertain situation that, you know, makes it very difficult for all scholars, all academic institutions, you know, how to, you know, deal with that situation and how to look forward. It creates an uncertain situation because the very basis that defines, you know, the socio-political relations in a society and makes them, you know, and put them together, is the law and order. So the law defines the nature of the order. When law is non-existent, Sharia law is open to interpretation, and they might interpret that in a way that serves their interests or their purpose, but not the, you know, the interests of the people, you know. So how you expect, you know, to build, you know, academic institutions based on a very fragile foundation, a foundation that might change, you know, on the daily basis based on the shifts and the interest in you know, in the calculations of the ruling authorities. So that's why, you know, that they are trying to build, you know, some support within these academic institutions by application of this madrasification, what I call it. So it means that they want to just, you know, create some basis within the academic society. Like if you go to Kabul University, so in every class, if you're a student of you know, like economics. So you have to study, you know, out of 10 subjects that you would study, you have to study 6 or 7 of them on religious issues, and then 3 or 4 on economic issues. And that, of course, you have not to touch, you know, ideas or theories in economics that contradicts, you know, the dominating ideology, of course, even for the purpose of knowing, you know, at least just having a knowledge, a simple, a basic information about that. So this is madrasification. They are trying to emulate that, you know, bring madrasa into, for example, Kabul University. That is, you know, devastating. That is destructive. That, you know, undermines the, you know, scientific dynamism of academic, you know, institutions in Afghanistan.
Great, thanks. I think that captures the scene that we are facing now and the nature of the Taliban authoritarian regime. With that, we come to the end of this episode. I'm sure that most of our listeners will agree with me that your stories and your perspectives are not just the tale of perseverance, but also a poignant reminder of vital role that the scholars like you play in preserving the truth, freedom, human dignity, even in the darkest times that countries like Afghanistan face. I was really honored to have you joining us today. Thank you so much for your
time. Thank you very much.